my pleasure to welcome back Anthony Esselin to the podium. He's been to, I think, all four of our conferences, The More Christianity. So he's a fixture, and I know people look forward to hearing him once again. So I will let that serve as an introduction up there.
Magdalene College.
It's not North. Oh well, we have it wrong in the new issue of Touchstone. We can't keep up with your changes.
No. They changed their name.
Oh, they changed their name. Okay. Well, it does say in the bio that Tony teaches English. Oh, and that's wrong too. Oh wow. So.
Tony, what are the college's pronouns?
What are their pronouns? So yeah. Anyway. Tony is a teacher, but I know Tony is as a writer, and first started publishing, I don't know what year, early 2000s. 2003, he remembers it well. And I remember the first times we got things from you, I thought, what a find. And he started just writing, and then I see his articles published somewhere else, and I go, oh, why didn't we get that? Why didn't we get that article? But then another article would come in, and all of a sudden I realized that Tony's like just writing and writing and writing. And then I thought, oh my, he's not going to be able to keep that up. A few years, he's going to run dry. Well, it hasn't happened. I don't know how you do it, but you'll hear something else that will most likely appear in the pages of Touchstone at some point. So please welcome Tony Esselin.
Samuel Johnson said that anybody who writes for any other reason than to earn money is a blockhead. I got a family to support, you know? I'm a little bit out of my element here tonight because I'm not going to do any stand-up comedy or impersonations. I have a rather formal and serious talk, which I hope will harmonize very well with what Ross has said, but coming at it from a different angle, a different approach. I too want to ask, what is the state of man in our times? Because we have to preach to man in our times. We have to preach in a shambles or a whorehouse. So we should know who it is to whom we would be preaching. And as I thought about this question, my mind turned to the greatest scholar of his time, who knew that he was living in an age of cultural decline. That man is Boethius. And since I'm speaking to Touchstone people, I probably have a lot of people in the audience who know who my man Bo was. Boethius, yes. He was awaiting a gruesome execution at the hands of the Goths, who had assumed lordship over the Roman state in the West. To that man's farsightedness, we owe much of what the Middle Ages would know we owe to him much of what they would know about Greek philosophy. He was an original thinker and a preserver, too, in bad times. The crown of his life's work, he did not live to achieve it, was to show that the philosophies of Plato and Aristotle were in harmony. And if there's anybody here from the University of Illinois, Plato and Aristotle were Greek philosophers of the... of the 4th century B.C. B.C. means before Christ. Boethius did, however, achieve a great deal. He kept alive in his place and time, not auspicious, that place and time, the very philosophies themselves. The only reason why he was in prison at all was that he was an old-fashioned Roman. He knew that his duty to his country was more important than his desire to live the rich but retired life of an esteemed scholar. He took what I would like to suggest tonight was the Boethius option. He worked in the political arena against his inclinations. Somebody had to do it. So he knew he lived in bad times, but he was not alienated. Okay? I'm going to try to explain this here. We see this lack of alienation. We see as much when he describes in the work that he wrote in prison as he was waiting execution, The Consolation of Philosophy. He describes the proudest day of his life when his two young sons, they're about 19, 20 years old, were elected to the consulship on the same day and were led in parade before the cheering crowds. And think about this. The office of consul, once the most powerful in the Roman state, was now not much more than an honorary title, as Boethius surely knew. He must have known. Yet he could, at that moment, think of consuls going back 1,000 years, really, 1,000 years to the days of the first Brutus, not the one who killed Julius Caesar, but Brutus, the liberator of the Roman people from domination by their neighbors, the sophisticated Etruscans and their kings. Boethius wrote, as I've said, in a tradition of learning going back 1,000 years to Socrates and Plato. He studied them not as an antiquarian, or what we now might call a new historicist. Socrates and Plato were really and urgently present to him, relevant to him. The poetry in the Consolation of Philosophy is written in prose and poetic forms interspersed. That poetry employs meters that bind him to lyric poets in Greek and Latin, and beyond them even to the great singers of the epic, that is Virgil and Homer, Homer living 1,300 years before Boethius wrote. Above all stand his Christian faith and his debts to Augustine and Athanasius and other Christian theologians, and his confidence, maintained to the end in a bad time and a bad situation, that his life and the lives of all men were in the hands of a just, all-wise, and almighty providence, the eternal, the self-same, never failing. Now think of the young man of our time. He is in his cave. He is not exercising the Benedict option. You don't know about St. Benedict. He is not part of a community of prayer. He is not exercising the Boethius option. He can hardly conceive of the virtue of piety and the demands it makes upon a good man, a good citizen. He is what Gabriel Marcel called a mass man. Options have been exercised for him already, not by masterminds and overlords, or not so much by them, but by the immense weight of a system of social manipulation. He believes in choice. It's almost the only thing he does believe in. But he has nothing of any very great moment to choose, as I see it anyway. Unlike Boethius, he is alienated. And I want to consider the ways in which is this so. I get letters from young people, sometimes quite angry, for having been cheated of their heritage of arts and letters. Just got one a couple of days ago. They somehow sense that it's not natural for man to be severed from his past. Man is not a dog or a cat that God has made to live in the present moment without history, without the great taproot of piety that drinks from the springs of what we've been given from our forebears long ago. But these young people who write to me, they know, somewhat abstractly, but it's also as a feeling, they know there's a feeling of not being settled, that they know that they're missing something. They try to recover it, flailing about sometimes, hardly knowing where to turn, by artificial means. They ask me for reading lists. They watch some classic movies. They are often unchurched. Well, they hardly know where to begin to heal that wound, if they begin at all. They're like people who have been shut up indoors all their lives. They are pallid, rickety, stunted, half smothered in the imagination. Then they step outside and they see the sun. And you think it'd be glorious and wonderful. It's frightening. They see the sun. They try a little bit every day to take a walk or turn a spade or sit on a rock somewhere. A lot better than nothing. Most people will not be like that. They will not know what they do not know. Now, somebody may say here, I get this objection quite a lot. They'll say, well, you know, people in the past had no great education either. Therefore, they had no strong connection to culture. Now we're all educated. That's not true. All men have had poetry, song, worship, and immemorial traditions. We're the outliers, as I see it. So I'm thinking here of a moment from an autobiographical novel by a fellow named Richard Llewellyn. The novel's called How Green Was My Valley. Anybody seen the movie? The movie is better than the book, by the way. The book is okay, but the movie is great. Two of the lads in the Morgan family are exasperated by the bad treatment that the coal miners of Cumaranda have received from the owners, and they're leaving home, they're leaving their village forever to emigrate to South America. Father, they say, may we have a chapter. You should think about that for a second. May we have a chapter. But this is evidently something that they have always done in the evening. And the father, Willem Morgan, Willem is Welsh for William, but it's Welsh, you know, reaches for the family Bible, and he chooses the 23rd Psalm, which he reads slowly with deep sorrow and resignation. And think of that moment. Think of the meaning of it. How everyone in the little thatched cottage knew that they lived in a world of profound significance. They could think of their exile as like that of the Jews after Jerusalem had been razed by the Babylonian armies. But they could yet trust that wherever they went, at least at that time, the God of their fathers would be with them. In fact, the Welsh in those days remained Welshmen wherever they went, whether to the Welsh-speaking colony deep in the interior of Argentina, where, in fact, Welsh is still spoken, or to the coal mining towns of Pennsylvania where I grew up. They spoke and sang and prayed in Erheniaith, the old tongue. That's what it was like with German Lutherans, Swedish Lutherans, French Catholics, Italian Catholics. For a while, anyway. They had cultural homes, thousands of miles away from where they were born. They had them, even though they had hardly gone to school at all. But modern man in his cave, mass man, has no such home, even if he has graduated from college and still lives in the basement of his parents' house. How can we expect he'll be rooted in culture? He does not feel himself to be rooted in his own body. Think of what alienation must already have occurred for people to believe that their bodies are wrong. Our colleague at Touchstone, Robert George, called a philosophical position self-body dualism. It's as if the self floating in space somewhere in a frail and ever-threatened imaginative space, felt the body as something alien to it, an accident, a thing to be used or transmogrified to attain the self's desires, whatever the self is. The very possibility of saying, I have the wrong body, would not have occurred to the people I'm describing from this Welsh semi-autobiographical novel. Not have occurred to Hugh Morgan, the youngest of the Morgan boys. His boyhood was affirmed at every pass, every hour of the day, by his father, his big brothers, also by his mother and his sister, who needed him to grow up to be a man and who saw to it that he did so. How do you know that you're a boy? You're chopping wood alongside your father, and your muscles are growing as strong as cables, even before the miracle of puberty. How do you know you're a girl? You're baking bread alongside your mother. You will have memories in your arms and hands and fingers of what it means to feed hungry people, from the toddler tugging at your skirt to the great exhausted man come in from the field. How do you know that boys and girls are meant for one another? You know it as you know that fresh air is good and the sky is blue. We are, Walker Percy said, lost in the cosmos, as if we were ourselves were the aliens that so many scientists aspire to meet. Other scientists, like the new atheists, aspire to the condition of robots. I mean, they hope, as David Bentley Hart has said, every little new atheist boy hopes to grow up to be a robot. But think of what it means to be lost in a cosmos. It requires no explanation that you might be lost in a chaos. What can you be but lost when there's no stable place to dwell in, no objects that endure from moment to moment, no law but lawlessness, and no personality? But to be lost in a cosmos? We dwell in a cosmos of astonishing beauty, but we do not see it. We must not see it, otherwise we would be eager to reflect it in our art, but our art celebrates the ugly, the transgressive — that's not my word, that's their word — the willful, the lawless. We must not see it because we do not see the cosmos that is as near to us as our flesh and blood. We do not see it in our bodies. Cosmos, by the way, suggests not a universe, it's an ordered, beautiful, harmonious whole. Hence, words that have to do in Greek and then adopted into English with decorating yourself, as in cosmetic, okay? If you are lost in a cosmos, it can only mean that you yourself are out of kilter. You are disordered and chaotic. Consider the vast intergalactic loneliness of our time. Ross has said, there's a lot of loneliness out there. I call our shift in sexual mores the lonely revolution. It has brought us not harmony and understanding, but alienation. It must have done so. It could have done no other. Fornication. And when was the last time you heard a Catholic priest preach about this? Fornication with no end beyond the pleasure of the act. And sometimes not much pleasure either, but a reprieve from loneliness or a chance to sweat off your anxieties. The fornication is essentially alienating. The man and woman do not unite fully as man and woman. They suppress the full knowledge of what they are doing. You have to remind them that it is the child-making thing they are doing that binds them to generations past and to come. They don't think so. They think that a woman can become pregnant by accident. I have told people, and I will pause for a joke here, I've told people that if you are walking down an alley beside a 10-story apartment building and a grand piano falls from a window at great height onto your head and you get a big bump, that is an accident. It is perhaps not very likely, but it is at least conceivable. It is not conceivable that you get pregnant by accident. The act has no meaning beyond itself. It doesn't even have the innocence of dogs in the natural throes of reproductive urgency. Divorce undoes the wisdom of Solomon. Mother and father agree to slice the child in half, to pretend that they can leave their marriage as persons whole and entire. Pornography. Conservatives often do not understand this, especially when they toe the feminist line about pornography. There's another angle to it that has to do with loneliness and alienation. What is it but often the dank and dark hole where lonely men, men who cannot find a woman — frankly, most of them do not deserve to find a woman either, but still, they cannot find a woman — submerge themselves in artificial excitations like heroin, less and less effective with every dose. Now, I could go farther here. No one's home, because in fact, no one is home. The house, maybe at best, is the family's haven from the outer world. The outer world is a world of masked men. No one knows anyone else. There are more cars on the street than children. Think of it. And young people grow up without the powerful memory of endless summer days when they played outdoors till they dropped, with kids they liked and kids they hated, but in any case with them, not alone. Memories almost as strong as those we should have, and often do not, from the family table and the parlor and the bedroom shared with a brother or sister, and conversations that could go long into the night. I go even farther, as far as heaven. Think about these two verses from Scripture and put them together. It is not good for the man to be alone, and remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. When the Lord God considers Adam, he sees his beloved creature as incomplete. And this is even after Adam has exercised godlike authority in naming the beasts. And God submits to be led by Adam in this case. Whatever he names them, they will be named. Adam cannot, however, fully bear the image of God, the three-person God as we Christians believe, unless he too is bound in relationship with a help who is meet for him. God made the light and beheld it as an artist beholds his work, and he declared it good, that man should be alone. This is the first thing in Scripture that is lo tov, not good. First thing in Scripture. Now, suppose we accept what even the pagans must have seen, right? Man and woman belong together. The family is the cradle of all human society. To some extent, it is also the end for which we have politicians and laws and armies and economies, that there should be thriving families everywhere. Is that enough, though? Is that enough for our human soul? Is that enough to stave off the alienation? Will man be relieved of his loneliness if he has a family and children? Is there no more? We are made in the image of God, and that means we're also made for God, participation in the life of eternal love, which is the Trinity. Even the pagans have dimly perceived something of this. The great German philosopher Joseph Pieper, who I'm channeling all through this talk, said that as a point of fact, there is no such thing as a feast without the gods. No matter how dim the memory may be, a feast to which the gods are not invited, or in which the gods are not invoked or praised, is quite simply an anthropological absurdity. It does not exist. We are, if we are united at all, we are united from above. Consider how the bonds of family life itself will grow frayed and fragile without the strength of religion. I mean it in its specific sense, the duty that we acknowledge to God. It's a good thing to remember playing ball with your brother. It's a good thing of altogether another dimension to remember singing a hymn with your brother. People who do not in some fashion come together in worship will soon not come together at all. When they lose the sense of belonging to God, they lose in turn the sense of belonging to one another, for all their cries for social justice is inevitable. For a while in some people, the loss of religious faith will be compensated by social action, but that ultimately fails to satisfy. It is empty. It does not soothe the heart. It's a bandage laid over the Grand Canyon. When the frustrations and the failures come, and they will, such people collapse into mere political actors with a vengeance. No one hates as bitterly as does a philanthropist. C.S. Lewis once imagined a race of semi-rational creatures, monopods, hopping about on one foot. They couldn't imagine that there were creatures somewhere walking on 2 feet. They'd rather deny the evidence of their senses than admit that possibility. That's our modern man. He is lonely. He's grown habituated to it. He can't imagine what a real society might look like. The basement is comforting because it is dim. He is faithless, but he's grown habituated to it. Can't imagine what it would be like to praise God from a full and joyful heart. And now I'm really talking about God, not within me, but without. Singing is strenuous. He has no hope in this world or the next. Doesn't understand what the word means. Hope is for man on the field of battle. Battle means danger. He has no culture to which we might appeal, from whose roots we might work. He's been told all his life that beauty does not exist. He seems determined to make that denial a reality. He has no strong connection to the natural world around him. He is still made by God, for the love of God and neighbor, made for genuine love. So what do we do with this alienated man? And I'm going to give you some recommendations right now. First, you can't give what you don't have. One alienated man can't save another. One drowning man pulls the other drowning man down. So we have to regard the wisdom and the practice of Saint Benedict. We must have, by intention, communities of prayer, healthy family life, and what is now called classical education, but was basically education in arts and letters, such as anybody would have recognized in 1920. We may reform some schools and colleges and social organizations here and there, as the case may admit. Sometimes you can save the limb. Sometimes it's full of gangrene and must be cut off, sooner the better. It is urgent that Christians build, always build. We have to build new schools, maybe new beneficent societies to aid the poor, the sick, and the dying. New groups, this is close to my heart, where boys can learn to be men under the tutelage of true men and not effeminate predators. Read real books, never been cheaper and easier to obtain. Build the imagination. The imagination is man's engine. It's the driver. Don't think that good catechesis can make up for the deficiency. We have the classics of literature. We have even the golden age of Hollywood on our side. We have allies. They've got names like Dickens, Hawthorne, Milton, Goethe, Shakespeare, Homer, Tolstoy. We have more recent allies with names like John Ford, William Wyler, Alfred Hitchcock, Elia Kazan, Howard Hawks. Enlist them. We must, above all, build families. They're not going to occur naturally and inevitably as the sun rises. All the traditions of courtship, even of the more recent thing called dating, they've all been forgotten. They were forgotten when I was at Princeton from 77 through 81. Nobody dated at Princeton. To say to a young man, even a young man of goodwill, hey, go mingle with the girls, ask one of them on a date. You might as well hand a wrench and a blowtorch to a 13-year-old boy with soft hands and say, go down the basement, fix the pipes. He can neither obey nor disobey. He doesn't know what the command means. Divorce is a scandal of our time, but unmarriage is worse, perhaps. I think it's worse. My wife certainly thinks it's worse. It is not good to be alone. If we do not arrange marriages, I got a daughter, if anybody is interested, okay? If we don't arrange those, we may arrange dances. Why are there not dances in our churches and parishes every week? Every week, not once a year. Every week. Dances, socials, and dates. And in the meantime, raise boys and girls, not just with a general expectation that someday they'd get married, but rather with the specific expectation that everything that they're doing when they're young by way of education is aimed ultimately so that they would get married and have a family. The home and not the place of employment is where the heart must lie if it is to beat warmly. We have to build, always build. We have to build the arts. Do you sing trash in your churches? There's no reason for that. Stupidity and ugliness are vices. They do not please God. Abel was careful, Cain was slovenly. You can't play a musical instrument, you say. This is not true. There is one instrument we can all play. It's of extraordinary power and poignancy and beauty. It is called the human voice. We can all use it, but then learn if you can to play the strings or the keys. If you have a talent for it, learn to paint. Learn to write real English verse in the old forms. Learn to turn marble, perhaps, if you have a special talent, into the body and the living breath of man. Don't expect greatness. We're working in a bad time. Expect goodness. Demand fidelity. Be humble enough to admit that we have more to recover than we can even begin to name. Then there is the Boethius option. You combine the hard work of preservation with the foul work of politics. You work with a few good people. Also with traitors, trimmers, demagogues, egotists, and blockheads. Boethius worked with and against Goths, murderous Goths. We must work with and against the addled and the vicious. We must do so because we love our country and because we want to pull as many people out of the quicksand as we can. We must also do so, and here I am making a confession because I did not believe this until recently. Our political enemies won't stop until even these small intentional communities that I've described and their organizations are crushed or are so vilified that if you are associated with one of them, you would never be able to become a doctor or a lawyer or a professor or an actor with work, or a basketball player, or a guy digging ditches for the county. I'm afraid, too, that the massiveness of state and corporate power will draw many weak souls towards the madness of the time. It's hard to be a flower against a skyscraper. The work, the Boethius work, has to be done. And again, I say this as somebody who is utterly disinclined for that work. But neither Benedict nor Boethius will, they will not ultimately suffice for people who are already alienated. So I'm going to recommend here, as I wind up, another line of attack, which I'm going to call the Bosco option, after St. John Bosco, who ministered to the street boys in 19th century Turin, and he built schools, founded an order of teachers. He combined kindness and cleanness of life with real shrewdness about the boys he wanted to save. And we need diagnosticians here from all walks of life and different varieties of experience. What characterizes the people that we want to go to? What's wrong with them? What have they got right? What's their nature? What are their evil habits? What's the disease to heal? He went among them in the streets. He appealed to their boyish natures. He was an athlete and an acrobat, so he strung a rope across a couple of the posts, and he walked a tightrope and juggled, performed magic tricks, and he won their interest. What boy can resist somebody walking a tightrope? He fed them. What boy can resist somebody feeding him? And he gave them what he could manage for a warm roof over their heads. He taught them. He never held back the truth. He taught them straightforwardly, confidently, but also with love. He loved them. Okay. We have to love, but we have to also to be clear about what the people need, because the people are sick. We too are sick, right? If you're sick, you want someone who knows what's wrong with you, not someone who has no notion of disease, but who is eager to help. It gives you the latest oil and alcohol concoction that he got from the traveling huckster. You don't want that. If you're sick in the soul, somebody who knows what's wrong with you but doesn't love you will also not do you much good. We have to be like John Bosco to the boys. We have to love them and be clear about their alienation, its causes, its character, and the prognosis. Jesus says, "Which man among you, if his son should ask him for an egg, would give him a scorpion?" We have people now without fathers to ask for anything. And we have people who demand scorpions instead of eggs. Partly they do this from perversity, mainly from ignorance and alienation and despair. Pope Francis calls the church a field hospital. I think it is. I don't know that he has the remedies for the diseases in it. I don't know if he even has the diagnoses. We should have the diagnoses. On a human level, we should have ready the remedies. Son is asking for an egg, not a scorpion. Not the bread from heaven yet, not yet at least, but we can give eggs. On the street of this new and terrible Turin, polished without but full of corruption and dead men's bones within, we meet young men, for instance, I'm giving you examples, you may think of many more. We meet young men who've never had a close male friend in all their lives. That's a fact. That's a new thing in the world, too. Profoundly sad. Some of them turn toward other men in a sexual way to relieve the alienation. Others won't, but will shy away from friendship for fear of its being misunderstood or scorned. That's a wound to heal. Well, John Bosco has to see to it. He knows what the sufferer does not know. He knows that this desire for the friendship is natural. He knows that every single civilization in the history of the world has been built upon the bonds of that friendship, the band of brothers, the team, the apostles even, the band of brothers to go forth and preach the word of God and baptize all nations. In the streets of this new Turin, he'll meet people who have never read a good book in all their lives. That's a fact. That's a fact of college students. They have no poetry. They have no long-loved folk songs by heart. They are alienated from culture itself. They can decipher words on the page. Maybe they'd be easier to heal if they could not do that, because they believe, inaccurately, that they know how to read. We must teach them to read. Won't be easy. Children like to read because it opens up the universe to them. But our street people, they've been taught to believe they know all there is to know about the world. They're like people who think they know the stars because they saw them reflected once in a puddle. Slowly and patiently, we have to teach them how to read good things. Maybe the first step will be to get them to watch a good movie, artfully crafted and true and good for the soul of man. Keep in mind, they do not know what they do not know. They think they know a great deal. They'll hesitate before the book of books, the Bible. They think they know what's in it, but they're afraid of it. It should strike them as strange. It should strike us as strange. We don't call for familiarity that ends in indifference. Great works of human thought and art hurl the earth out from under our feet. So should a real encounter with the Bible do 10 times over. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. I believe it. I rejoice in it. Far be it from me to say that I understand it or comprehend it. The creature cannot comprehend the Creator. It's a joy for the creature to know that. In the streets of this Turin of steel and glass, he sees people hurrying off to work. The work they do seems to have as its result the building of a city of steel and glass. Alienated people build up an alien city. We talk about community. The people who are into social justice talk about community. Where's that to be found? In cubicles? Why do we work? Alienated man does not know why. We work because otherwise we're worthless. Sometimes we work because the alternative is even lonelier than work. We work for money. Money is for the pursuit of your pleasure. Why do we build? We doesn't know. Why with our vast wealth do we build things that are ugly or that express a vindictive desire to crush man like a bug? We must bring to this alienated man what he doesn't know, the nourishing reality of leisure. I don't mean vacant time, vacation. He's got enough of those. He's vacuous enough already. I mean leisure that partakes of the feast. When is this street person, this white-collar laborer jacketed and tied up, when has he known a feast? Parties? Yeah. Debauchery? Perhaps. Unless his loneliness has kept him from debauchery. But a feast? French peasant hoeing potatoes in the field knew what it was to celebrate a feast. When the Angelus bell rang from the nearby church, he was reminded of it. Russian serf cutting barley with his sickle knew what it was to celebrate a feast. He goes home and he sees a little icon in his shelf, and it reminds him of it. Our alienated man does not know it. We have to bring the feast his way. And the feast implies the presence of the divine. I don't mean that you hang a banner outside of your church saying, all are welcome. That's self-congratulation. We take the mystery and the joy of the feast into the streets. The secular people these days are willing, grudgingly perhaps, to grant us freedom of worship because they're afraid of freedom of religion. They're afraid it'll be too public a thing. Okay, then let's have freedom of worship and make it a public thing. Bring it out. Bring it forth. Bring it outdoors. It's going to make people uncomfortable. Make them uncomfortable. All truly great things make us uncomfortable. Is it comfortable to gaze upon the paintings of Michelangelo in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel? Comfortable? Is that you describe it as comfortable to listen to Bach's St. Matthew Passion? True love is beyond comfort. So true sorrow, true joy. Does it ever occur to us outside of our congregations, Roman Catholics, even inside the congregations, most people alive have never heard a group of their neighbors singing from a full heart about what stirs them to the core of their beings? That's an experience that human beings have always known till our time, never to have had it. It's like never having beheld a sunrise or water rushing in a stream. In this new tour in no one's home, I'm not the first to say it, Romano Guardini said it, we've lost the sense that we live in a cosmos, a haven for man. Man has not been made humble by the accomplishments of modern science. He has been made proud, and he has been humiliated. And the two go together, said Guardini. Gabriel Marcel said it when he wrote against mass man suffering the techniques of mass manipulation and degradation, mass advertising, and mass politics. We have to bring man home. Every man we meet is an orphan. So are we. We are lost. If we relied on our own intelligence and strength of will, we would achieve nothing. But we have one who has gone before us to mark the way. His name is not John Bosco. He is the way, the truth, and the life. He does not merely give us the answers we seek. He is not a sage or a guru. He is the answer we seek. His cross is the span over the abyss. Ultimately, we and the lost souls we want to help must meet that cross. So let us do so outdoors. Out there among them with good cheer and bold faith, there is no alternative. Thank you.